the teaching of pain. Sadly, Katie's story is no anomaly. Far too many creative people have been taught to distrust pleasure and to put their faith in struggle alone. Too many artists still believe that anguish is the only truly authentic emotional experience. They could have picked up this dark idea anywhere. It's a commonly held belief here in the Western world, what with our weighty emotional heritage of Christian sacrifice and German Romanticism, both of which give excessive credence to the merits of agony. Trusting in nothing but suffering is a dangerous path, though. Suffering has a reputation for killing off artists, for one thing. But even when it doesn't kill them, an addiction to pain can sometimes throw artists into such severe mental disorder that they stop working at all. My favorite refrigerator magnet says, "I've suffered enough. When does my artwork improve?" Perhaps you, too, were taught to trust in darkness. Maybe you were even taught darkness by creative people whom you loved and admired. I certainly was. When I was in high school, a beloved English teacher once told me, "You're a talented writer, Liz, but unfortunately you'll never make it because you haven't suffered enough in your life." What a twisted thing to say. First of all, what does a middle-aged man know about a teenage girl's suffering? I had probably suffered more that day at lunch than he'd suffered in his entire lifetime. But beyond that, since when did creativity become a suffering contest? I had admired that teacher. Imagine if I'd taken his words to heart and had dutifully set out on some shadowy Byronic quest for authenticating tribulation. Mercifully, I didn't. My instincts drove me in the opposite direction, toward light, toward play, toward a more trusting engagement with creativity. But I'm a lucky one. Others do go on that dark crusade, and sometimes they go there on purpose. "All my musical heroes were junkies, and I just wanted to be one too," says my dear friend Rhea Elias, a gifted songwriter who battled heroin addiction for over a decade, during which time she lived in prison, on the streets, and in mental hospitals, and completely stopped making music. Rhea isn't the only artist who ever mistook self-destruction for a serious-minded commitment to creativity. The jazz saxophonist Jackie McLean said that back in Greenwich Village in the 1950s, he watched dozens of aspiring young musicians take up heroin in order to imitate their hero, Charlie Parker. More tellingly still, McLean says, he witnessed many young jazz aspirants pretending to be heroin addicts, eyes half closed, striking that slouched pose, even as Parker himself begged people not to emulate this most tragic aspect of himself. But maybe it's easier to do heroin or even to romantically pretend to do heroin than it is to commit yourself wholeheartedly to your craft. Addiction does not make the artist. Raymond Carver, for one, intimately knew this to be true. He himself was an alcoholic, and he was never able to become the writer he needed to be, not even on the subject of alcoholism itself, until he gave up the booze. As he said, "Any artist who is an alcoholic is an artist despite their alcoholism, not because of it." I agree. I believe that our creativity grows like sidewalk weeds out of the cracks between our pathologies, not from the pathologies themselves. But so many people think it's the other way around. For this reason, you will often meet artists who deliberately cling to their suffering, their addictions, their fears, their demons. They worry that if they ever let go of all that anguish, their very identities would vanish. Think of Rilke, who famously said, "If my devils are to leave me, I'm afraid my angels will take flight as well." Rilke was a glorious poet, and that line is elegantly rendered, but it's also severely emotionally warped. Unfortunately, I've heard that line quoted countless times by creative people who were offering up an excuse as to why they won't quit drinking, or why they won't go see a therapist, or why they won't consider treatment for their depression or anxiety, or why they won't address their sexual misconduct or their intimacy problems, or why they basically refuse to seek personal healing and growth in any manner whatsoever, because they don't want to lose their suffering, which they have somehow conflated and confused with their creativity. People have a strange trust in their devils, indeed. Our better angels. I want to make something perfectly clear here. I do not deny the reality of suffering. Not yours, not mine, not humanity's in general. It is simply that I refuse to fetishize it. I certainly refuse to deliberately seek out suffering in the name of artistic authenticity. As Wendell Berry warned, to attribute to the muse a special fondness for pain is to come too close to desiring and cultivating pain. To be sure, the tormented artist is sometimes an all-too-real person, Without a doubt, there are many creative souls out there who suffer from severe mental illness. Then again, there are also hundreds of thousands of severely mentally ill souls out there who do not happen to possess extraordinary artistic talents. So to automatically conflate madness with genius feels like a logical fallacy to me. But we must be wary of the lure of the tormented artist, because sometimes it's a persona, a role that people grow accustomed to playing. It can be a seductively picturesque role, too, with a certain dark and romantic glamour to it. And it comes with an extremely useful side benefit, namely built-in permission for terrible behavior. If you are the tormented artist, after all, then you have an excuse for treating your romantic partners badly, for treating yourself badly, for treating your children badly, for treating everyone badly. You are allowed to be demanding, arrogant, rude, cruel, antisocial, grandiose, explosive, moody, manipulative, irresponsible, and/or selfish. You can drink all day and fight all night. If you behaved this badly as a janitor or a pharmacist, people would rightfully call you out as a jackass. But as the tormented artist, you get a pass because you're special, because you're sensitive and creative, because sometimes you make pretty things. I don't buy it. I believe you can live a creative life and still make an effort to be a basically decent person. I'm with the British psychoanalyst Adam Phillips on this point when he observes, "If the art legitimates cruelty, I think the art is not worth having." I've never been attracted to the icon of the tormented artist, not even during adolescence when that figure can seem particularly sexy and alluring to romantic-minded girls like me. It never appealed to me then, though, and it still doesn't appeal to me now. What I've seen already of pain is plenty, thank you, and I do not raise my hand and ask for more of it. I've also been around enough mentally ill people to know better than to sentimentalize madness. What's more, I've passed through enough seasons of depression, anxiety, and shame in my own life to know that such experiences are not particularly generative for me. I have no great love or loyalty for my personal devils because they have never served me well. During my own periods of misery and instability, I've noticed that my creative spirit becomes cramped and suffocated. I've found that it's nearly impossible for me to write when I'm unhappy, and it is definitely impossible for me to write fiction when I'm unhappy. In other words, I can either live a drama or I can invent a drama, but I do not have the capacity to do both at the same time. Emotional pain makes me the opposite of a deep person. It renders my life narrow and thin and isolated. My suffering takes this whole thrilling and gigantic universe and shrinks it down to the size of my own unhappy head. When my personal devils take over, I can feel my creative angels retreating. They watch my struggle from a safe distance, but they worry. Also, they grow impatient. It's almost as if they're saying, "Lady, please hold it together. We've got so much more work to do." My desire to work, my desire to engage with my creativity as intimately and as freely as possible, is my strongest personal incentive to fight back against pain by any means necessary, and to fashion a life for myself that is as sane and healthy and stable as it can possibly be. But that's only because of what I have chosen to trust, which is, quite simply, love. Love over suffering, always. Choose what to trust. If you choose to go the other way, though, if you choose to trust suffering over love, be aware that you are building your house upon a battlefield. And when so many people treat their creative process as a war zone, is it any wonder that there are such severe casualties, so much despair, so much darkness, and at such a cost? I won't even attempt to list the names of all the writers, poets, artists, dancers, composers, actors, and musicians who have committed suicide in the past century, or who died long before their time from that slowest of suicidal tactics, alcoholism. You want the numbers? The internet will give you the numbers, but believe me, it's a grim reaping. These lost prodigies were unhappy for an infinite variety of reasons, to be sure, though I'm willing to bet that they had all, at least for one flowering moment of their lives, once loved their work. Yet if you'd asked any of these gifted, troubled souls whether they'd ever believed that their work loved them in return, I suspect they would have said no. But why wouldn't it have? This is my question, and I think it's a fair one. Why would your creativity not love you? It came to you, didn't it? It drew itself near. It worked itself into you, asking for your attention and your devotion. It filled you with the desire to make and do interesting things. Creativity wanted a relationship with you. That must be for a reason, right? Do you honestly believe that creativity went through all the trouble of breaking into your consciousness only because it wanted to kill you? That doesn't even make sense. How does creativity possibly benefit from such an arrangement? When Dylan Thomas dies, there are no more Dylan Thomas poems. That channel is silenced forever, terribly. I cannot imagine a universe in which creativity would possibly desire that outcome. I can only imagine that creativity would much prefer a world in which Dylan Thomas had continued to live and to produce for a long, natural life. Dylan Thomas and 1,000 others besides. There's a hole in our world from all the art those people did not make. There's a hole in us from the loss of their work, and I cannot imagine this was ever anyone's divine plan. Because think about it. If the only thing an idea wants is to be made manifest, then why would that idea deliberately harm you when you are the one who might be able to bring it forth? Nature provides the seed, man provides the garden, each is grateful for the other's help. Is it possible, then, that creativity is not fucking with us at all, but that we have been fucking with it? Stubborn gladness. All I can tell you for certain is that my entire life has been shaped by an early decision to reject the cult of artistic martyrdom, and instead to place my trust in the crazy notion that my work loves me as much as I love it, that it wants to play with me as much as I want to play with it, and that this source of love and play is boundless. I have chosen to believe that a desire to be creative was encoded into my DNA for reasons I will never know, and that creativity will not go away from me unless I forcibly kick it away or poison it dead. Every molecule of my being has always pointed me toward this line of work, toward language, storytelling, research, narrative. If destiny didn't want me to be a writer, I figure, then it shouldn't have made me one, but it did make me one, and I've decided to meet that destiny with as much good cheer and as little drama as I can, because how I choose to handle myself as a writer is entirely my own choice. I can make my creativity into a killing field, or I can make it into a really interesting cabinet of curiosities. I can even make it into an act of prayer. My ultimate choice, then, is to always approach my work from a place of stubborn gladness. I worked for years with stubborn gladness before I was published. I worked with stubborn gladness when I was still an unknown new writer whose first book sold just a handful of copies, mostly to members of my own family. I worked with stubborn gladness when I was riding high on a giant bestseller. I worked with stubborn gladness when I was not riding high on a giant bestseller anymore, and when my subsequent books did not sell millions of copies. I worked with stubborn gladness when critics praised me, and I worked with stubborn gladness when critics made fun of me. I've held to my stubborn gladness when my work is going badly, and also when it's going well. I don't ever choose to believe that I've been completely abandoned in the creative wilderness, or that there's reason for me to panic about my writing. I choose to trust that inspiration is always nearby the whole time I'm working, trying its damnedest to impart assistance. It's just that inspiration comes from another world, you see, and it speaks a language entirely unlike my own, so sometimes we have trouble understanding each other. But inspiration is still sitting right there beside me, and it is trying. Inspiration is trying to send me messages in every form it can, through dreams, through portents, through clues, through coincidences, through deja vu, through kismet, through surprising waves of attraction and reaction, through the chills that run up my arms, through the hair that stands up on the back of my neck, through the pleasure of something new and surprising, through stubborn ideas that keep me awake all night long. Whatever works. Inspiration is always trying to work with me. So I sit there and I work too. That's the deal. I trust it. It trusts me. Choose your delusion. Is this delusional? Is it delusional of me to place infinite trust in a force that I cannot see, touch, or prove, a force that might not even actually exist? Okay, for the sake of argument, let's call it totally delusional. But is it any more delusional than believing that only your suffering and your pain are authentic, or that you are alone, that you have no relationship whatsoever with the universe that created you, or that you have been singled out by destiny as specially cursed, or that your talents were given to you for the mere purpose of destroying you? What I'm saying is this. If you're going to live your life based on delusions, and you are, because we all do, then why not at least select a delusion that is helpful? Allow me to suggest this one. The work wants to be made, and it wants to be made through you. The Martyr versus the Trickster. But in order to let go of the addiction to creative suffering, you must reject the way of the martyr and embrace the way of the trickster. We all have a bit of trickster in us, and we all have a bit of martyr in us. Okay, some of us have a lot of martyr in us. But at some point in your creative journey, you will have to make a decision about which camp you wish to belong to, and therefore which parts of yourself to nourish, cultivate, and bring into being. Choose carefully. As my friend, the radio personality Caroline Casey always says, better a trickster than a martyr be. What's the difference between a martyr and a trickster, you ask? Here's a quick primer. Martyr energy is dark, solemn, macho, hierarchical, fundamentalist, austere, unforgiving, and profoundly rigid. Trickster energy is light, sly, transgender, transgressive, animist, seditious, primal, and endlessly shape-shifting. Martyr says, I will sacrifice everything to fight this unwinnable war, even if it means being crushed to death under a wheel of torment. Trickster says, okay, you enjoy that. As for me, I'll be over here in this corner running a successful little black market operation on the side of your unwinnable war. Martyr says, life is pain. Trickster says, life is interesting. Martyr says, the system is rigged against all that is good and sacred. Trickster says, there is no system, everything is good, and nothing is sacred. Martyr says, nobody will ever understand me. Trickster says, pick a card, any card. Martyr says, the world can never be solved. Trickster says, perhaps not, but it can be gamed. Martyr says, through my torment, the truth shall be revealed. Trickster says, I didn't come here to suffer, pal. Martyr says, death before dishonor. Trickster says, let's make a deal. Martyr always ends up dead in a heap of broken glory, while Trickster trots off to enjoy another day. Martyr equals Sir Thomas More. Trickster equals Bugs Bunny. Trickster Trust. I believe that the original human impulse for creativity was born out of pure trickster energy. Of course it was. Creativity wants to flip the mundane world upside down and turn it inside out, and that's exactly what a trickster does best. But somewhere in the last few centuries, creativity got kidnapped by the martyrs, and it's been held hostage in their camp of suffering ever since. I believe this turn of events has left art feeling very sad. It has definitely left a lot of artists feeling very sad. It's time to give creativity back to the tricksters, is what I say. The trickster is obviously a charming and subversive figure, but for me, the most wonderful thing about a good trickster is that he trusts. It may seem counterintuitive to suggest this because he can seem so slippery and shady, but the trickster is full of trust. He trusts himself, obviously. He trusts his own cunning, his own right to be here, his own ability to land on his feet in any situation. To a certain extent, of course, he also trusts other people in that he trusts them to be marks for his shrewdness. But mostly, the trickster trusts the universe. He trusts in its chaotic, lawless, ever-fascinating ways, and for this reason, he does not suffer from undue anxiety. He trusts that the universe is in constant play, and specifically, that it wants to play with him. A good trickster knows that if he cheerfully tosses a ball out into the cosmos, that ball will be thrown back at him. It might be thrown back really hard, or it might be thrown back really crooked, or it might be thrown back in a cartoonish hail of missiles, or it might not be thrown back till the middle of next year, but that ball will eventually be thrown back. The trickster waits for the ball to return, catches it however it arrives, and then tosses it back out there into the void again, just to see what will happen. And he loves doing it because the trickster, in all his cleverness, understands the one great cosmic truth that the martyr, in all his seriousness, can never grasp. It's all just a game. A big, freaky, wonderful game. Which is fine because the trickster likes freaky. Freaky is his natural environment. The martyr hates freaky. The martyr wants to kill freaky. And in so doing, he all too often ends up killing himself. A good trickster move. I'm friends with Brené Brown, the author of Daring Greatly and other works on human vulnerability. Brené writes wonderful books, but they don't come easily for her. She sweats and struggles and suffers through the writing process and always has. But recently I introduced Brené to this idea that creativity is for tricksters, not for martyrs. It was an idea she'd never heard before. As Brené explains, hey, I come from a background in academia, which is deeply entrenched in martyrdom. As in, you must labor and suffer for years in solitude to produce work that only four people will ever read. But when Brené latched onto this idea of tricksterdom, she took a closer look at her own work habits and realized she'd been creating from far too dark and heavy a place within herself. She had already written several successful books, but all of them had been like a medieval road of trials for her, nothing but fear and anguish throughout the entire writing process. She had never questioned any of this anguish, because she'd assumed it was all perfectly normal. After all, serious artists can only prove their merit through serious pain. Like so many creators before her, she had come to trust in that pain above all. But when she tuned into the possibility of writing from a place of trickster energy, she had a breakthrough. She realized that the act of writing itself was indeed genuinely difficult for her, but that storytelling was not. Brené is a captivating storyteller, and she loves public speaking. She's a fourth-generation Texan who can string a tale like nobody's business. She knew that when she spoke her ideas aloud, they flowed like a river. But when she tried to write those ideas down, they cramped up on her. Then she figured out how to trick the process. For her last book, Brené tried something new, a super cunning trickster move of the highest order. She enlisted two of her dearest friends to join her at a beach house in Galveston to help her finish her book, which was under serious deadline. Let me be more clear about how exactly she did this, because it's brilliant. Brené Brown paid her friends to join her at the beach. She paid them to sit there on the couch and take detailed notes while she told them stories about the subject of her book. After each story, she would grab her friend's notes, run into the other room, shut the door, and write down exactly what she had just told them while they waited patiently in the living room. Thus, Brené was able to capture the natural tone of her own speaking voice on the page, much the way the poet Ruth Stone figured out how to capture poems as they moved through her. Then Brené would dash back into the living room and read aloud what she had just written. Her friends would help her to tease out the narrative even further by asking her to explain herself with new anecdotes and stories, as again they took notes, and again Brené would grab those notes and go transcribe the stories. By setting a trickster trap for her own storytelling, Brené figured out how to catch her own tiger by the tail. Much laughter and absurdity were involved in this process. They were, after all, just three girlfriends alone at a beach house. There were taco runs and beer runs and visits to the golf. They had a blast. This scene is pretty much the exact opposite of the stereotypical image of the tormented artist sweating it out alone in his garret studio. But as Brené told me, I'm done with all that. Never again will I write about the subject of human connection while suffering in isolation. And her new trick worked like a charm. Never had Brené written faster, never had she written better, never had she written with such trust. Mind you, this was not a book of comedy that she was writing either. A lighthearted process does not necessarily need to result in a lighthearted product. Brené is a renowned sociologist who studies shame, after all. This was a book about vulnerability, failure, anxiety, despair, and hard-earned emotional resilience. Her book came out on the page just as deep and serious as it needed to be. It's just that she had a good time writing it, because she finally figured out how to game the system. In so doing, she finally accessed her own abundant source of big magic. That's how a trickster gets the job done. Lightly, lightly, ever lightly. Lighten Up. The first short story I ever published was in 1993 in Esquire magazine. The story was called Pilgrims. It was about a girl working on a ranch in Wyoming, and it was inspired by my own experience as a girl who had worked on a ranch in Wyoming. As usual, I sent the story out to a bunch of publications unsolicited. As usual, everyone rejected it. Except one. A young assistant editor at Esquire named Tony Freund plucked my story out of the slush pile and brought it to the editor-in-chief, a man named Terry McDonnell. Tony suspected that his boss might like the story because he knew Terry had always been fascinated with the American West. Terry did indeed like Pilgrims, and he purchased it, and that's how I got my first break as a writer. It was the break of a lifetime. The story was slated to appear in the November issue of Esquire, with Michael Jordan on the cover. A month before the issue was to go to press, however, Tony called me to say there was a problem. A major advertiser had pulled out, and as a result, the magazine would need to be several pages shorter than planned that month. Sacrifices would have to be made. They were looking for volunteers. I was given a choice. I could either cut my story by 30% so that it would fit in the new, slimmer November issue, or I could pull it from the magazine entirely and hope it would find a home, intact, in some future issue. "I can't tell you what to do," Tony said. "I will completely understand if you don't want to butcher your work like this. I think the story will indeed suffer from being amputated. It might be better for you, then, if we wait a few months and publish it intact. But I also have to warn you that the magazine world is an unpredictable business. There may be an argument for striking while the iron is hot. Your story might never get published if you hesitate now. Terry might lose interest in it, or who knows, he might even leave his job at Esquire and move to another magazine, and then your champion will be gone. So I don't know what to tell you. The choice is yours." Do you have any idea what it means to cut 30% from a 10-page short story? I'd worked on that story for a year and a half. It was like polished granite by the time Esquire got their hands on it. There was not a superfluous word in it, I believed. What's more, I felt that Pilgrims was the best thing I'd ever written, and as far as I knew, I might never write that well again. It was deeply precious to me, the blood of my blood. I couldn't imagine how the story would even make sense anymore, amputated like that. Above all, my dignity as an artist was offended by the very idea of mutilating my life's best work simply because a car company had pulled an advertisement from a men's magazine. What about integrity? What about honor? What about pride? If artists do not uphold a standard of incorruptibility in this nefarious world, who will? On the other hand, screw it. Because let's be honest, it wasn't the Magna Carta we were talking about here. It was just a short story about a cowgirl and her boyfriend. I grabbed a red pencil, and I cut that thing down to the bone. The initial devastation to the narrative was shocking. The story had no meaning or logic anymore. It was literary carnage. But that's when things started to get interesting. Looking over this hacked-up mess, it dawned upon me that this was a rather fantastic creative challenge. Could I still manage to make it work? I began suturing the narrative back together into a sort of sense. As I pieced and pinned sentences together, I realized that the cuts had indeed transformed the entire tone of the story, but not necessarily in a bad way. The new version was neither better nor worse than the old version. It was just profoundly different. It felt leaner and harder, not unappealingly austere. I never would have written that way, naturally. I hadn't known I could write that way, and that revelation alone intrigued me. It was like one of those dreams where you discover a previously unknown room in your house and you have that expansive feeling that your life has more possibility to it than you thought it did. I was amazed to discover that my work could be played with so roughly, torn apart, chopped up, reassembled, and that it could still survive, perhaps even thrive, within its new parameters. What you produce is not necessarily always sacred, I realized, just because you think it's sacred. What is sacred is the time that you spend working on the project and what that time does to expand your imagination and what that expanded imagination does to transform your life. The more lightly you can pass that time, the brighter your existence becomes. It ain't your baby. When people talk about their creative work, they often call it their baby, which is the exact opposite of taking things lightly. A friend of mine, a week before her new novel was to be published, told me, "I feel like I'm putting my baby on the school bus for the first time, and I'm afraid the bullies will make fun of him." Truman Capote stated it even more bluntly. He said, "Finishing a book is just like you took a child out in the backyard and shot it." Guys, please don't mistake your creative work for a human child, okay? This kind of thinking will only lead you to deep psychic pain. I'm dead serious about this. Because if you honestly believe that your work is your baby, then you will have trouble cutting away 30% of it someday, which you may very well need to do. You also won't be able to handle it if somebody criticizes or corrects your baby, or suggests that you might consider completely modifying your baby, or even tries to buy or sell your baby on the open market. You might not be able to release your work or share it at all, because how will that poor, defenseless baby survive without you hovering over it and tending to it? Your creative work is not your baby. If anything, you are its baby. Everything I have ever written has brought me into being. Every project has matured me in a different way. I am who I am today precisely because of what I have made and what it has made me into. Creativity has hand-raised me, and forged me into an adult, starting with my experience with that short story, Pilgrims, which taught me how not to act like a baby. All of which is to say that yes, in the end, I did squeeze an abbreviated version of Pilgrims into the November 1993 issue of Esquire by the skin of its teeth. A few weeks later, as fate would have it, Terry McDonnell, my champion, did indeed leave his job as editor-in-chief of the magazine. Whatever short stories and feature articles he left behind never saw the light of day. Mine would have been among them, buried in a shallow grave, had I not been willing to make those cuts. But I did make the cuts, thank heavens, and the story was cool and different because of it, and I got my big break. My story caught the eye of the literary agent who signed me up and who has now guided my career with grace and precision for more than 20 years. When I look back on that incident, I shudder at what I almost lost. Had I been more prideful, somewhere in the world today, probably in the bottom of my desk drawer, there would be a short story called Pilgrims, 10 pages long, which nobody would have ever read. It would be untouched and pure, like polished granite, and I might still be a bartender. I also think it's interesting that once Pilgrims was published in Esquire, I never really thought about it again. It was not the best thing I would ever write, not even close. I had so much more work ahead of me, and I got busy with that work. Pilgrims was not a consecrated relic, after all. It was just a thing that I had made and loved and then changed and then remade and still loved and then published and then put aside so that I could go on to make other things. Thank God I didn't let it become my undoing. What a sad and self-destructive act of martyrdom that would have been, to have rendered my writing so inviolable that I defended its sanctity to its very death. Instead, I put my trust in play, in pliancy, in trickery. Because I was willing to be light with my work, that short story became not a grave, but a doorway that I stepped through into a wonderful and bigger new life. Be careful of your dignity, is what I'm saying. It is not always your friend. Passion versus curiosity. May I also urge you to forget about passion? Perhaps you're surprised to hear this from me, but I am somewhat against passion, or at least I am against the preaching of passion. I don't believe in telling people all you need to do is follow your passion and everything will be fine. I think this can be an unhelpful and even cruel suggestion at times. First of all, it could be an unnecessary piece of advice, because if someone has a clear passion, odds are they're already following it, and they don't need anyone to tell them to pursue it. That's kind of the definition of a passion, after all, an interest that you chase obsessively, almost because you have no choice. But a lot of people don't know exactly what their passion is, or they may have multiple passions, or they may be going through a midlife change of passion, all of which can leave them feeling confused and blocked and insecure. If you don't have a clear passion and someone blithely tells you to go follow your passion, I think you have the right to give that person the middle finger. Because that's like somebody telling you that all you need in order to lose weight is to be thin, or all you need in order to have a great sex life is to be multi-orgasmic. That doesn't help. I'm generally a pretty passionate person myself, but not every single day. Sometimes I have no idea where my passion has gone off to. I don't always feel actively inspired, nor do I always feel certain about what to do next. But I don't sit around waiting for passion to strike me. I keep working steadily because I believe it is our privilege as humans to keep making things for as long as we live and because I enjoy making things. Most of all, I keep working because I trust that creativity is always trying to find me, even when I have lost sight of it. So how do you find the inspiration to work when your passion has flagged? That's where curiosity comes in. Devotion to inquisitiveness. I believe that curiosity is the secret. Curiosity is the truth and the way of creative living. Curiosity is the alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end. Furthermore, curiosity is accessible to everyone. Passion can seem intimidatingly out of reach at times. A distant tower of flame, accessible only to geniuses and to those who are specially touched by God. But curiosity is a milder, quieter, more welcoming, and more democratic entity. The stakes of curiosity are also far lower than the stakes of passion. Passion makes you get divorced and sell all your possessions and shave your head and move to Nepal. Curiosity doesn't ask nearly so much of you. In fact, Curiosity only ever asks one simple question. Is there anything you're interested in? Anything, even a tiny bit, no matter how mundane or small. The answer need not set your life on fire or make you quit your job or force you to change your religion or send you into a fugue state. It just has to capture your attention for a moment. But in that moment, if you can pause and identify even one tiny speck of interest in something, then curiosity will ask you to turn your head a quarter of an inch and look at the thing a wee bit closer. Do it. It's a clue. It might seem like nothing, but it's a clue. Follow that clue. Trust it. See where curiosity will lead you next. Then follow the next clue and the next and the next. Remember, it doesn't have to be a voice in the desert. It's just a harmless little scavenger hunt. Following that scavenger hunt of curiosity can lead you to amazing, unexpected places. It may even eventually lead you to your passion, albeit through a strange, untraceable passageway of back alleys, underground caves, and secret doors. Or it may lead you nowhere. You may spend your whole life following your curiosity and have absolutely nothing to show for it at the end, except one thing. You will have the satisfaction of knowing that you passed your entire existence in devotion to the noble human virtue of inquisitiveness. And that should be more than enough for anyone to say that they have lived a rich and splendid life. The scavenger hunt. Let me give you an example of where the scavenger hunt of curiosity can lead you. I've already told you the story of the greatest novel I never wrote, that book about the Amazon jungle, which I neglected to nurture and which eventually jumped out of my consciousness and into Ann Patchett's consciousness. That book had been a passion project. That idea had come to me in a brainwave of physical and emotional excitement and inspiration. But then I got distracted by life's exigencies, and I didn't work on that book, and it left me. So it goes, and so it went. After that Amazon jungle idea was gone, I didn't have another brainwave of physical and emotional excitement and inspiration right away. I kept waiting for a big idea to arrive, and I kept announcing to the universe that I was ready for a big idea to arrive. But no big ideas arrived. There were no goosebumps, no hairs standing up on the back of my neck, no butterflies in my stomach. There was no miracle. It was like St. Paul rode his horse all the way to Damascus and nothing happened, except maybe it rained a bit. Most days, this is what life is like. I poked about for a while in my everyday chores, writing emails, shopping for socks, resolving small emergencies, sending out birthday cards. I took care of the orderly business of life. As time ticked by, and an impassioned idea still had not ignited me, I didn't panic. Instead, I did what I have done so many times before. I turned my attention away from passion and toward curiosity. I asked myself, is there anything you're interested in right now, Liz? Anything, even a tiny bit, no matter how mundane or small. It turned out there was. Gardening. I know. Contain your excitement, everyone. Gardening. I had recently moved to a small town in rural New Jersey. I'd bought an old house that came with a nice backyard. Now I wanted to plant a garden in that backyard. This impulse surprised me. I'd grown up with a garden, a huge garden, which my mother had managed efficiently, but I'd never been much interested in it. As a lazy child, I'd worked quite hard not to learn anything about gardening, despite my mother's best efforts to teach me. I had never been a creature of the soil. I didn't love country life back when I was a kid. I found farm chores boring, difficult, and sticky, and I had never sought it out as an adult. An aversion to the hard work of country living is exactly why I'd gone off to live in New York City, and also why I'd become a traveler, because I didn't want to be any kind of farmer. But now I'd moved to a town even smaller than the town in which I'd grown up, and now I wanted a garden. I didn't desperately want a garden, understand? I wasn't prepared to die for a garden or anything. I just thought a garden would be nice. Curious. The whim was small enough that I could have ignored it. It barely had a pulse. But I didn't ignore it. Instead, I followed that small clue of curiosity, and I planted some things. As I did so, I realized that I knew more about this gardening business than I thought I knew. Apparently, I had accidentally learned some stuff from my mother back when I was a kid, despite my very best efforts not to. It was satisfying to uncover this dormant knowledge. I planted some more things. I recalled some more childhood memories. I thought more about my mother, my grandmother, my long ancestry of women who worked the earth. It was nice. As the season passed, I found myself seeing my backyard with different eyes. What I was raising no longer looked like my mother's garden. It was starting to look like my own garden. For instance, unlike my mom, a masterful vegetable gardener, I wasn't all that interested in vegetables. Rather, I longed for the brightest, showiest flowers that I could get my hands on. Furthermore, I discovered that I didn't want to merely cultivate these plants. I also wanted to know stuff about them. Specifically, I wanted to know where they had come from. Those heirloom irises that ornamented my yard, for instance, what was their origin? I did exactly 1 minute of research on the internet and learned that my irises were not indigenous to New Jersey. They had, in fact, originated in Syria. That was kind of cool to discover. Then I did some more research. The lilacs that grew around my property were apparently descendants of similar bushes that had once bloomed in Turkey. My tulips also originated in Turkey, though there had been a lot of interfering Dutchmen, it turned out, between those original wild Turkish tulips and my domesticated, fancy varieties. My dogwood was local. My forsythia wasn't, though. That came from Japan. My wisteria was also rather far from home. An English sea captain had brought the stuff over to Europe from China, and then British settlers had brought it to the New World, and rather recently, actually. I started running background checks on every single plant in my garden. I took notes on what I was learning. My curiosity grew. What intrigued me, I realized, was not so much my garden itself, but the botanical history behind it, a wild and little-known tale of trade and adventure and global intrigue. That could be a book, right? Maybe. I kept following the trail of curiosity. I elected to trust completely in my fascination. I elected to believe that I was interested in all this botanical trivia for a good reason. Accordingly, portents and coincidences began to appear before me, all related to this newfound interest in botanical history. I stumbled upon the right books, the right people, the right opportunities. For instance, the expert whose advice I needed to seek out about the history of mosses lived, it turned out, only a few minutes from my grandfather's house in rural upstate New York. And a 200-year-old book that I had inherited from my great-grandfather held the key I'd been searching for, a vivid historic character worthy of embellishing into a novel. It was all right in front of me. Then I started to go a little crazy with it. My search for more information about botanical exploration eventually led me around the planet, from my backyard in New Jersey to the Horticultural Libraries of England, from the Horticultural Libraries of England to the Medieval Pharmaceutical Gardens of Holland, from the Medieval Pharmaceutical Gardens of Holland to the moss-covered caves of French Polynesia. 3 years of research and travel and investigation later, I finally sat down to begin writing The Signature of All Things, a novel about a fictional family of 19th-century botanical explorers. It was a novel I never saw coming. It had started with nearly nothing. I did not leap into that book with my hair on fire. I inched toward it, clue by clue. But by the time I looked up from my scavenger hunt and began to write, I was completely consumed with passion about 19th-century botanical exploration. 3 years earlier, I had never even heard of 19th-century botanical exploration. All I had wanted was a modest garden in my backyard. But now I was writing a massive story about plants and science and evolution and abolition and love and loss and one woman's journey into intellectual transcendence. So it worked. But it only worked because I said yes to every single tiny clue of curiosity that I had noticed around me. That's big magic too, you see. It's big magic on a quieter scale. And on a slower scale. But make no mistake about it, it's still big magic. You just have to learn how to trust it. It's all about the yes. That's interesting. The creators who most inspire me then are not necessarily the most passionate, but the most curious. Curiosity is what keeps you working steadily while hotter emotions may come and go. I like that Joyce Carol Oates writes a new novel every 3 minutes and on such a wide range of subjects because so many things seem to fascinate her. I like that James Franco takes whatever acting job he wants, serious drama 1 minute, campy comedy the next, because he recognizes that it doesn't all have to earn him an Oscar nomination. And I like that between acting gigs, he also pursues his interests in art, fashion, academia, and writing. Is his extracurricular creativity any good? I don't care. I just like that the dude does whatever he wants. I like that Bruce Springsteen doesn't merely create epic stadium anthems, but also once wrote an entire album based on a John Steinbeck novel. I like that Picasso messed around with ceramics. I once heard the director Mike Nichols speak about his prolific film career, and he said he'd always been really interested in his failures. Whenever he saw one of them airing on late-night TV, he would sit down and watch it all over again, something that he never did with his successes. He would watch with curiosity, thinking, "That's so interesting how that scene didn't work out." No shame, no despair, just a sense that it's all very interesting. Like, isn't it funny how sometimes things work and other times they don't? Sometimes I think that the difference between a tormented creative life and a tranquil creative life is nothing more than the difference between the word awful and the word interesting. Interesting outcomes, after all, are just awful outcomes with the volume of drama turned way down. I think a lot of people quit pursuing creative lives because they're scared of the word interesting. My favorite meditation teacher, Pema Chodron, once said that the biggest problem she sees with people's meditation practice is that they quit just when things are starting to get interesting, which is to say, they quit as soon as things aren't easy anymore, as soon as it gets painful or boring or agitating. They quit as soon as they see something in their minds that scares them or hurts them. So they miss the good part, the wild part, the transformative part, the part when you push past the difficulty and enter into some raw, new, unexplored universe within yourself. And maybe it's like that with every important aspect of your life. Whatever it is you are pursuing, whatever it is you are seeking, whatever it is you are creating, be careful not to quit too soon. As my friend, Pastor Rob Bell, warns, don't rush through the experiences and circumstances that have the most capacity to transform you. Don't let go of your courage the moment things stop being easy or rewarding, because that moment, that's the moment when interesting begins. Hungry ghosts. You will fail. It sucks, and I hate to say it, but it's true. You will take creative risks, and often they will not pan out. I once threw away an entire completed book because it didn't work. I diligently finished the thing, but it really didn't work, so I ended up throwing it away. I don't know why it didn't work. How can I know? What am I, a book coroner? I have no certificate for the cause of death. The thing just didn't work. It makes me sad when I fail. It disappoints me. Disappointment can make me feel disgusted with myself or surly toward others. By this point in my life, though, I've learned how to navigate my own disappointment without plummeting too far into death spirals of shame, rage, or inertia. That's because, by this point in my life, I have come to understand what part of me is suffering when I fail. It's just my ego. It's that simple. Now, I've got nothing against egos, broadly speaking. We all have one. Some of us might even have two. Just as you need your fear for basic human survival, you also need your ego to provide you with the fundamental outlines of selfhood, to help you proclaim your individuality, define your desires, understand your preferences, and defend your borders. Your ego, simply put, is what makes you who you are. Without one, you're nothing but an amorphous blob. Therefore, as the sociologist and author Martha Beck says of the ego, don't leave home without it. But do not let your ego totally run the show, or it will shut down the show. Your ego is a wonderful servant, but it's a terrible master, because the only thing your ego ever wants is reward, reward, and more reward. And since there's never enough reward to satisfy, your ego will always be disappointed. Left unmanaged, that kind of disappointment will rot you from the inside out. An unchecked ego is what the Buddhists call a hungry ghost, forever famished, eternally howling with need and greed. Some version of that hunger dwells within all of us. We all have that lunatic presence living deep within our guts that refuses to ever be satisfied with anything. I have it, you have it, we all have it. My saving grace is this, though. I know that I am not only an ego, I am also a soul. And I know that my soul doesn't care a whit about reward or failure. My soul is not guided by dreams of praise or fears of criticism. My soul doesn't even have language for such notions. My soul, when I tend to it, is a far more expansive and fascinating source of guidance than my ego will ever be, because my soul desires only one thing, wonder. And since creativity is my most efficient pathway to wonder, I take refuge there, and it feeds my soul, and it quiets the hungry ghost, thereby saving me from the most dangerous aspect of myself. So whenever that brittle voice of dissatisfaction emerges within me, I can say, ah, my ego, there you are, old friend. It's the same thing when I'm being criticized and I notice myself reacting with indignation, heartache, or defensiveness. It's just my ego flaring up and testing its power. In such circumstances, I have learned to watch my heated emotions carefully, but I try not to take them too seriously because I know that it's merely my ego that has been wounded, never my soul. It is merely my ego that wants revenge or to win the biggest prize. It is merely my ego that wants to start a Twitter war against a hater or to sulk at an insult or to quit in righteous indignation because I didn't get the outcome I wanted. At such times, I can always steady my life once more by returning to my soul. I ask it, and what is it that you want, dear one? The answer is always the same. More wonder, please. As long as I'm still moving in that direction, toward wonder, then I know that I will always be fine in my soul, which is where it counts. And since creativity is still the most effective way for me to access wonder, I choose it. I choose to block out all the external and internal noise and distractions and to come home again and again to creativity. Because without that source of wonder, I know that I am doomed. Without it, I will forever wander the world in a state of bottomless dissatisfaction. Nothing but a howling ghost, trapped in a body made of slowly deteriorating meat. And that ain't gonna do it for me, I'm afraid. Do something else. So how do you shake off failure and shame in order to keep living a creative life? First of all, forgive yourself. If you made something and it didn't work out, let it go. Remember that you're nothing but a beginner. Even if you've been working on your craft for 50 years, we are all just beginners here, and we shall all die beginners. So let it go. Forget about the last project and go searching with an open heart for the next one. Back when I was a writer for GQ magazine, my editor-in-chief, Art Cooper, once read an article I'd been working on for 5 months, an in-depth travel story about Serbian politics that had cost the magazine a small fortune, by the way. And he came back to me an hour later with this response. This is no good, and it will never be any good. You don't have the capacity to write this story, as it turns out. I don't want you to waste another minute on this thing. Move on to the next assignment immediately, please. Which was rather shocking and abrupt, but holy cow, talk about efficiency. Dutifully, I moved on. Next, 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 always next. Keep moving, keep going. Whatever you do, try not to dwell too long on your failures. You don't need to conduct autopsies on your disasters. You don't need to know what anything means. Remember, the gods of creativity are not obliged to explain anything to us. Own your disappointment, acknowledge it for what it is, and move on. Chop up that failure and use it for bait to try to catch another project. Someday, it might all make sense to you, why you needed to go through this botched-up mess in order to land in a better place, or maybe it will never make sense. So be it. Move on anyhow. Whatever else happens, stay busy. I always lean on this wise advice from the 17th century English scholar Robert Burton on how to survive melancholy. Be not solitary. Be not idle. Find something to do, anything, even a different sort of creative work altogether, just to take your mind off your anxiety and pressure. Once when I was struggling with a book, I signed up for a drawing class just to open up some other kind of creative channel within my mind. I can't draw very well, but that didn't matter. The important thing was that I was staying in communication with artistry at some level. I was fiddling with my own dials, trying to reach inspiration in any way possible. Eventually, after enough drawing, the writing began to flow again. Einstein called this tactic combinatory play, the act of opening up one mental channel by dabbling in another. This is why he would often play the violin when he was having difficulty solving a mathematical puzzle. After a few hours of sonatas, he could usually find the answer he needed. Part of the trick of combinatory play, I think, is that it quiets your ego and your fears by lowering the stakes. I once had a friend who was a gifted baseball player as a young man, but he lost his nerve and his game fell apart. So he quit baseball and took up soccer for a year. He wasn't the greatest soccer player, but he liked it, and it didn't break his spirit so much when he failed because his ego knew this truth. Hey, I never claimed it was my game. What mattered is only that he was doing something physical in order to bring himself back into his own skin, in order to get out of his own head, and in order to reclaim some sense of bodily ease. Anyhow, it was fun. After a year of kicking around a soccer ball for laughs, he went back to baseball, and suddenly he could play again, better and more lightly than ever. In other words, if you can't do what you long to do, go do something else. Go walk the dog, go pick up every bit of trash on the street outside your home, go walk the dog again, go bake a peach cobbler, go paint some pebbles with brightly colored nail polish and put them in a pile. You might think it's procrastination, but with the right intention, it isn't. It's motion. And any motion whatsoever beats inertia, because inspiration will always be drawn to motion. So wave your arms around, make something, do anything. Call attention to yourself with some sort of creative action. And most of all, trust that if you make enough of a glorious commotion, eventually inspiration will find its way home to you again. Paint your bicycle. The Australian writer, poet, and critic Clive James has a perfect story about how once, during a particularly awful creative dry spell, he got tricked back to work. After an enormous failure, a play that he wrote for the London stage, which not only bombed critically but also ruined his family financially and cost him several dear friends, James fell into a dark morass of depression and shame. After the play closed, he did nothing but sit on the couch and stare at the wall, mortified and humiliated, while his wife somehow held the family together. He couldn't imagine how he would ever get up the courage to write anything else ever again. After a long spell of this funk, however, James's young daughters finally interrupted his grieving process with a request for a mundane favor. They asked him if he would please do something to make their shabby old secondhand bicycles look a bit nicer. Dutifully, but not joyfully, James obeyed. He hauled himself up off the couch and took on the project. First, he carefully painted the girls' bikes in vivid shades of red. Then he frosted the wheel spokes with silver and striped the seat posts to look like barber's poles. But he didn't stop there. When the paint dried, he began to add hundreds of tiny silver and gold stars, a field of exquisitely detailed constellations all over the bicycles. The girls grew impatient for him to finish, but James found that he simply could not stop painting stars. Four-pointed stars, six-pointed stars, and the very rare eight-pointed stars with peripheral dots. It was incredibly satisfying work. When at last he was done, his daughters pedaled off on their magical new bikes, thrilled with the effect, while the great man sat there, wondering what on earth he was going to do with himself next. The next day, his daughters brought home another little girl from the neighborhood who asked if Mr. James might please paint stars on her bicycle, too. He did it. He trusted in the request. He followed the clue. When he was done, another child showed up, and another, and another. Soon there was a line of children all waiting for their humble bicycles to be transformed into stellar objets d'art. And so it came to pass that one of the most important writers of his generation spent several weeks sitting in his driveway, painting thousands and thousands of tiny stars on the bicycles of every child in the area. As he did so, he came to a slow discovery. He realized that failure has a function. It asks you whether you really want to go on making things. To his surprise, James realized that the answer was yes. He really did want to go on making things. For the moment, all he wanted to make were beautiful stars on children's bicycles, but as he did so, something was healing within him. Something was coming back to life, because when the last bike had been decorated and every star in his personal cosmos had been diligently painted back into place, Clive James at last had this thought: I will write about this one day. And in that moment, he was free. The failure had departed. The creator had returned. By doing something else, and by doing it with all his heart, he had tricked his way out of the hell of inertia and straight back into the big magic. Fierce trust. The final, and sometimes most difficult, act of creative trust is to put your work out there into the world once you have completed it. The trust that I'm talking about here is the fiercest trust of all. This is not a trust that says, I am certain I will be a success, because that is not fierce trust. That is innocent trust. And I am asking you to put aside your innocence for a moment and to step into something far more bracing and far more powerful. As I have said, and as we all know deep in our hearts, there is no guarantee of success in creative realms, not for you, not for me, not for anyone, not now, not ever. Will you put forth your work anyhow? I recently spoke to a woman who said, I'm almost ready to start writing my book, but I'm having trouble trusting that the universe will grant me the outcome I want. Well, what could I tell her? I hate to be a buzzkill, but the universe might not grant her the outcome she wants. Without a doubt, the universe will grant her some kind of outcome. Spiritually minded people would even argue that the universe will probably grant her the outcome she needs, but it might not grant her the outcome she wants. Fierce trust demands that you put forth the work anyhow, because fierce trust knows that the outcome does not matter. The outcome cannot matter. Fierce trust asks you to stand strong within this truth. You are worthy, dear one, regardless of the outcome. You will keep making your work regardless of the outcome. You will keep sharing your work regardless of the outcome. You were born to create regardless of the outcome. You will never lose trust in the creative process, even when you don't understand the outcome. There is a famous question that shows up, it seems, in every single self-help book ever written. What would you do if you knew that you could not fail? But I've always seen it differently. I think the fiercest question of all is this one. What would you do even if you knew that you might very well fail? What do you love doing so much that the words failure and success essentially become irrelevant? What do you love even more than you love your own ego? How fierce is your trust in that love? You might challenge this idea of fierce trust. You might buck against it. You might want to punch it and kick at it. You might demand of it, why should I go through all the trouble to make something if the outcome might be nothing? The answer will usually come with a wicked trickster grin. Because it's fun, isn't it? Anyhow, what else are you going to do with your time here on Earth? Not make things? Not do interesting stuff? Not follow your love and your curiosity? There is always that alternative, after all. You have free will. If creative living becomes too difficult or too unrewarding for you, you can stop whenever you want. But seriously, really? Because think about it. Then what? Walk proudly. 20 years ago, I was at a party talking to a guy whose name I have long since forgotten or maybe never even knew. Sometimes I think this man came into my life for the sole purpose of telling me this story, which has delighted and inspired me ever since. The story this guy told me was about his younger brother, who was trying to be an artist. The guy was deeply admiring of his brother's efforts, and he told me an illustrative anecdote about how brave and creative and trusting his little brother was. For the purposes of this story, which I shall now recount here, let's call the little brother, Little Brother. Little Brother, an aspiring painter, saved up all his money and went to France to surround himself with beauty and inspiration. He lived on the cheap, painted every day, visited museums, traveled to picturesque locations, bravely spoke to everyone he met, and showed his work to anyone who would look at it. One afternoon, Little Brother struck up a conversation in a cafe with a group of charming young people who turned out to be some species of fancy aristocrats. The charming young aristocrats took a liking to Little Brother and invited him to a party that weekend in a castle in the Loire Valley. They promised Little Brother that this was going to be the most fabulous party of the year. It would be attended by the rich, by the famous, and by several crowned heads of Europe. Best of all, it was to be a masquerade ball where nobody skimped on the costumes. It was not to be missed. Dress up, they said, and join us. Excited, Little Brother worked all week on a costume that he was certain would be a showstopper. He scoured Paris for materials and held back neither on the details nor the audacity of his creation. Then he rented a car and drove to the castle 3 hours from Paris. He changed into his costume in the car and ascended the castle steps. He gave his name to the butler, who found him on the guest list, and politely welcomed him in. Little Brother entered the ballroom, head held high. Upon which, he immediately realized his mistake. This was indeed a costume party. His new friends had not misled him there, but he had missed one detail in translation. This was a themed costume party. The theme was a medieval court, and little brother was dressed as a lobster. All around him, the wealthiest and most beautiful people of Europe were attired in gilded finery and elaborate period gowns, draped in heirloom jewels, sparkling with elegance as they waltzed to a fine orchestra. Little brother, on the other hand, was wearing a red leotard, red tights, red ballet slippers, and giant red foam claws. Also, his face was painted red. This is the part of the story where I must tell you that little brother was over 6 feet tall and quite skinny, but with the long, waving antennas on his head, he appeared even taller. He was also, of course, the only American in the room. He stood at the top of the steps for one long, ghastly moment. He almost ran away in shame. Running away in shame seemed like the most dignified response to the situation, but he didn't run. Somehow he found his resolve. He'd come this far, after all. He'd worked tremendously hard to make this costume, and he was proud of it. He took a deep breath and walked onto the dance floor. He reported later that it was only his experience as an aspiring artist that gave him the courage and the license to be so vulnerable and absurd. Something in life had already taught him to just put it out there, whatever it is. That costume was what he had made, after all. So that's what he was bringing to the party. It was the best he had. It was all he had. So he decided to trust in himself, to trust in his costume, to trust in the circumstances. As he moved into the crowd of aristocrats, a silence fell. The dancing stopped. The orchestra stuttered to a stop. The other guests gathered around little brother. Finally, someone asked him what on earth he was. Little brother bowed deeply and announced, "I am the court lobster." Then, laughter. Not ridicule, just joy. They loved him. They loved his sweetness, his weirdness, his giant red claws, his skinny ass, and his bright spandex tights. He was the trickster among them, and so he made the party. Little brother even ended up dancing that night with the Queen of Belgium. This is how you must do it, people. I have never created anything in my life that did not make me feel, at some point or another, like I was the guy who just walked into a fancy ball wearing a homemade lobster costume. But you must stubbornly walk into that room regardless, and you must hold your head high. You made it, you get to put it out there. Never apologize for it, never explain it away, never be ashamed of it. You did your best with what you knew, and you worked with what you had in the time that you were given. You were invited, and you showed up, and you simply cannot do more than that. They might throw you out, but then again, they might not. They probably won't throw you out, actually. The ballroom is often more welcoming and supportive than you could ever imagine. Somebody might even think you're brilliant and marvelous. You might end up dancing with royalty. Or you might just end up having to dance alone in the corner of the castle with your big, ungainly red foam claws waving in the empty air. That's fine, too. Sometimes it's like that. What you absolutely must not do is turn around and walk out. Otherwise, you will miss the party. And that would be a pity, because please believe me, we did not come all this great distance and make all this great effort only to miss the party at the last moment. Part 6. Divinity. Accidental grace. My final story comes from Bali, from a culture that does creativity quite differently than we do it here in the West. This story was told to me by my old friend and teacher, Catutlier, a medicine man who took me under his wing years ago to share with me his considerable wisdom and grace. As Catut explained to me, Balinese dance is one of the world's great art forms. It is exquisite, intricate, and ancient. It is also holy. Dances are ritually performed in temples as they have been for centuries under the purview of priests. The choreography is vigilantly protected and passed from generation to generation. These dances are intended to do nothing less than to keep the universe intact. Nobody can claim that the Balinese do not take their dancing seriously. Back in the early 1960s, mass tourism reached Bali for the first time. Visiting foreigners immediately became fascinated with the sacred dances. The Balinese are not shy about showing off their art, and they welcomed tourists to enter the temples and watch the dancing. They charged a small sum for this privilege. The tourists paid, and everyone was happy. As touristic interest in this ancient art form increased, however, the temples became overcrowded with spectators. Things got a bit chaotic. Also, the temples were not particularly comfortable as the tourists had to sit on the floor with the spiders and dampness and such. Then some bright Balinese soul had the terrific idea to bring the dancers to the tourists instead of the other way around. Wouldn't it be nicer and more comfortable for the sunburned Australians if they could watch the dances from, say, a resort swimming pool area instead of from inside a damp, dark temple? Then the tourists could have a cocktail at the same time and really enjoy the entertainment. And the dancers could make more money because there would be room for bigger audiences. So the Balinese started performing their sacred dances at the resorts in order to better accommodate the paying tourists, and everyone was happy. Actually, not everyone was happy. The more high-minded of the Western visitors were appalled. This was desecration of the sublime. These were sacred dances. This was holy art. You can't just do a sacred dance on the profane property of a beach resort, and for money, no less. It was an abomination. It was spiritual, artistic, and cultural prostitution. It was sacrilege. These high-minded Westerners shared their concerns with the Balinese priests, who listened politely despite the fact that the hard and unforgiving notion of sacrilege does not translate easily into Balinese thinking, nor are the distinctions between sacred and profane quite so unambiguous as they are in the West. The Balinese priests were not entirely clear as to why the high-minded Westerners viewed the beach resorts as profane at all. Did divinity not abide there as well as anywhere else on earth? Similarly, they were unclear as to why the friendly Australian tourists in their clammy bathing suits should not be allowed to watch sacred dances while drinking Mai Tais. Were these nice-seeming and friendly people undeserving of witnessing beauty? But the high-minded Westerners were clearly upset by this whole turn of events, and the Balinese famously do not like to upset their visitors, so they set out to solve the problem. The priests and the masters of the dance all got together and came up with an inspired idea. An idea inspired by a marvelous ethic of lightness and trust. They decided that they would make up some new dances that were not sacred, and they would perform only these certified divinity-free dances for the tourists at the resorts. The sacred dances would be returned to the temples and would be reserved for religious ceremonies only. And that is exactly what they did. They did it easily, too, with no drama and no trauma. Adapting gestures and steps from the old sacred dances, they devised what were essentially gibberish dances and commenced performing these nonsense gyrations at the tourist resorts for money, and everybody was happy because the dancers got to dance, the tourists got to be entertained, and the priests earned some money for the temples. Best of all, the high-minded Westerners could now relax because the distinction between the sacred and the profane had been safely restored. Everything was in its place, tidy and final. Except that it was neither tidy nor final, because nothing is ever really tidy or final. The thing is, over the next few years, those silly new meaningless dances became increasingly refined. The young boys and girls grew into them, and working with a new sense of freedom and innovation, they gradually transformed the performances into something quite magnificent. In fact, the dances were becoming rather transcendent. In another example of an inadvertent seance, it appeared that those Balinese dancers, despite all their best efforts to be completely unspiritual, were unwittingly calling down big magic from the heavens anyhow, right there by the swimming pool. All they'd originally intended to do was to entertain tourists and themselves, but now they were tripping over God every single night, and everyone could see it. It was arguable that the new dances had become even more transcendent than the stale, old, sacred ones. The Balinese priests, noticing this phenomenon, had a wonderful idea. Why not borrow the new fake dances, bring them into the temples, incorporate them into the ancient religious ceremonies, and use them as a form of prayer? In fact, why not replace some of those stale, old, sacred dances with the new fake dances? So they did. At which point, the meaningless dances became holy dances, because the holy dances had become meaningless. And everyone was happy, except for those high-minded Westerners who were now thoroughly confused because they couldn't tell anymore what was holy and what was profane. It had all bled together. The lines had blurred between high and low, between light and heavy, between right and wrong, between us and them, between God and Earth, and the whole paradox was totally freaking them out. Which I cannot help but imagine is what the trickster priests had in mind the entire time. In conclusion, creativity is sacred and it is not sacred. What we make matters enormously and it doesn't matter at all. We toil alone and we are accompanied by spirits. We are terrified and we are brave. Art is a crushing chore and a wonderful privilege. Only when we are at our most playful can divinity finally get serious with us. Make space for all these paradoxes to be equally true inside your soul, and I promise you can make anything. So please calm down now and get back to work, okay? The treasures that are hidden inside you are hoping you will say yes. This is Elizabeth Gilbert. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. This program was directed by Garrett Scott, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2015 by Elizabeth Gilbert. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA LLC, a Penguin Random House company. All rights reserved.